Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Jack Spencer, Mike Malott, Jacob Kanzler. Our special guests this week are Bob McCann from Cover 2 and Sarah Werfel from Trescott Rossman, and also State Representative Ann Boland from Brighton Township. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, a couple things we want to talk to you about, because you have some experience in working with the public in doing government functions as a longtime clerk at Brighton Township. Jacob Kanzler was able to do some real good research over the last several months dealing with critical incidences at the Secretary of State's office. We led our edition with it this past Friday, and what we're finding is that the lines are getting longer at the Secretary of State's office, and people are losing their cool. Before we hand it over to you, Jacob, why don't we just kind of talk briefly about how this story came together and why we began looking into the critical incidences at the Secretary of State's offices.
So here's where it started. Last year, Governor Whitmer's first action was to create a pipeline for state employees to report critical incidences to the public health and welfare directly to her office. Now, I was interested to see what, if anything, had been reported.
And what is a critical incident? What is that?
Just, you know, anything that a public employee feels is a detriment to the health or safety or welfare of the public. It seemed like it was kind of inspired by the Flint water crisis. So when we got the reports, the Secretary of State's office had more of these reports than any other department combined, about 53 out of the 60 or so total. And so I was very interested to see what these reports were. And a lot of them, well, most of them were from branch offices, from Secretary of State's office in 2019. And we got a number of very disturbing incidences, multiple cases of customers getting angry, threatening clerks, throwing stuff at clerks, customers getting in fights inside and outside branches. So a lot of very serious things, kind of showing a lot of tensions in various branch offices. What made this very interesting is that it was kind of hard to get a sense of whether this was normal. Because this critical incident pipeline of reporting, this was the first year that this has happened, it really seemed like it was the first time that we had a formal paper trail of these things even being reported. The other thing too is the Secretary of State Benson and her staff have encouraged branch offices to report these things when they happen, because in the past they said that they were not reporting these because they felt like the folks in Lansing wouldn't be doing anything. So it was kind of hard to tell whether this was a typical year at the Secretary of State's office. The one thing that was interesting that was a takeaway is that there was definitely a connection made between the wait times and the lines and kind of tensions rising and impatience happening with some of these incidences.
Along with that, then, we were also taking a look at the wait times at the Secretary of State's offices. And this past year, the average wait time was 52 minutes. And then you look at the wait time in just January of 2020, and the wait time, average wait time for all 131 branches was 58 minutes. I mean, we're practically talking an hour now that people are waiting. Now, obviously, the numbers on that varied wildly. You had some out in Timbuktu where the average wait time was 5 minutes. But then you get into Metro Detroit, let's say Novi, the wait time was 4 hours. Detroit, the average wait time for last year was 2 hours. Westland, well, it was another one where the wait times were long. Pontiac, another example. So anytime you got into an urban area, the wait times got higher. And it's not hard to overlap these two pieces of data to see that people are losing their cool waiting in line.
Yeah, and I was trying to do my best to kind of show that the incidences were happening all over the state. They weren't in just, you know, certain parts of the state. There were people making threats and saying things, you know, anywhere from Sturgis to Temperance. And so there really were just these constant themes of people getting upset and taking it out on clerks or each other. And a lot of the reports did capture this tie to the wait times, where it said the customer was specifically angry because he had been waiting so long, or another instance where someone can't do their business, they didn't have the documents or what have you, and the frustration seemed to stem from that.
So Representative Boland, what can we do about this situation? Is there anything that you think that we can do to try and speed things along at the branch offices? Is that something the legislature might want to take a look at?
I think that the legislature, yes, we should take a look at it. What are the resources? What are the Secretary of State's plans to address these lines? Including now we have an expansion into grocery stores and banks. We need to make sure that those are actually secure access for the customer. Working to do our job in communicating how, why, and when people can transact their business. I think that's all important and moving in the right direction. But I think the question does have to be answered. We were able to meet these line times and service people. What's happened in the last maybe 12 to 18 months that has changed that?
Sarah, you've been in PR for a while. What would you suggest here for Secretary Benson? Because obviously this isn't necessarily her fault, yet she's going to shoulder all the blame for this.
Right. Well, and overall, and I think Representative Boland makes a great point, is the sheer number of transactions that happen across the state, and it pretty much affects every Michigander, right? You have to go in, your driver's licenses are going to expire, your tabs are going to do whatever else, recreation passports now, which is a big part of Michigan. So it's a real significant issue, and I know just as somebody who just has that another year around the sun, my car plates were expiring and had to go do it. I went to hop online. It was actually pretty easy, but I think it's that digital first. I think it's like strong communication and really trying to get at the bottom of what's really happening, what has changed. There could clearly have been some computer glitches. I was a big fan of that text when your appointment to go in when you couldn't actually do something online where you have to physically go in person, and that was an amazing service. Mm-hmm. And without that functionality working, I think it just becomes people get frustrated, right? Which goes back to the incidents that Jacob was talking about earlier.
I'm wondering, how much of a problem would this be if everyone who didn't have to go in, you have to go in for the eye test, et cetera, and the new picture, but what if everyone who didn't have to go in was doing it online? Would that cut down on this considerably, do you think?
Yes, I do think it would cut down on it considerably. But I also think, again, it goes back to, when you go and you're conducting business or transaction with people that are working in the public sector, I think it's important. These are people too. So if you pack your patience, bring your manners, courtesy goes a long way. And I think just as a society, we need to encourage people to go back to the basics and use their manners. Those are people, they have families just like the rest of us. They don't want to make you wait when you come to the Secretary of State's office. So certainly encouraging people, go online, making sure they have opportunities. You get your annual renewal and there are four or five pieces of paper in it. I hear over and over, I don't read that stuff. Well, again, I think we do our best to communicate people, but you can bring them to water, you can't force them to drink.
Everybody knows how old I am, so there's no point in dwelling on that, but I had occasion a few times in the 70s to be in a Michigan unemployment office, and as far as people being patient, et cetera, it seemed like they had card tables set up in line and were playing cards and were literally there all day, so it may be a cultural thing that we're just now used to instantaneous service. Whereas a few years ago, you kind of accepted some of those things.
Bob, you've been in government for a while and have seen how different branches work. What's kind of your take on this? This doesn't seem like a partisan issue. This seems more of a, more of a clerical issue.
Sure. Clearly we're looking at some systemic problems within the Secretary of State's office that can and need to be fixed. But a particular problem for Secretary Benson right now is the expectation that she set during her campaign of a 30-minute guarantee. And so regardless of who's at fault or how far back these problems go that are creating these delays, people heard 30-minute guarantee on a campaign, and here we are a year later, and the delays have only gotten worse. So she has somewhat of a perception problem she's going to have to address here quickly. of getting those systems fixing the, so that she can claim that, you know, we are making progress towards that goal instead of sliding further backwards. So it's an uphill battle, to be sure. But when you set those expectations, you have to figure out a plan to meet them.
One other thing I wanted to bring up here, and Jake was able to pull this out of the budget, that the governor wants to put in additional money for security guards at some of these branch offices where there could be some flashpoints, some problems. Do you see that having any problem getting through the legislature, Representative?
I do.
Do you?
I think that, you know, we have 53 incidents out of potentially how many. I think sometimes when we think we're acting in a way to be precautionary, what we're actually doing is inviting trouble.
Really?
Yes. I think that maybe we have to work with the public, find different ways to educate them, find ways that are actually going to help them do their business with the Secretary of State's office, and then putting up all these defenses. I just don't think they go towards. I know these are different times. We have to worry about people's security, the workers' security. But when we keep placating to that, I think we find ourselves in more of trouble. We're still not fixing the problem. Now you're going to go in and you're going to see a guard in uniform, increase use of taxpayers' dollars. Maybe those dollars would be better spent with more machines, more tellers, more kiosks.
Is it out of the question to reopen some branch offices and have some more branch offices again? You think that's out of the question?
No, I don't think that's out of the question, but there is a cost with everything. I think I would like to see the Secretary of State's office, and the same for other offices too, is try to partner, have some private-public collaboration initiatives, expanding out into the grocery stores, banks. I think that those are all good ideas. They need to be secure. Are they really servicing people? And then I think we have to come back and weigh, really, what's the return on the investment? If it is a minimal number of transactions being placed elsewhere, then we have to come back and really have the nerve to say, nope, that didn't work. That was not worth the investment. Let's draw back. The state, many years ago during the recession, decided to close these branch offices as a way to save money and not to invest in their own buildings. And so these rental agreements sometimes are inadequate. They're long-term. The space itself has not been flexible enough to change with the times, like the more demand with more computers, kiosks, things like that. So, you know, we're doing business differently, and maybe we're using, you know, old framework that needs some adjustment.
You know, you mentioned the whole idea of maybe moving branch office functions elsewhere. That's part of a package that I think Representative Maddox has out there. He's also thinking about getting rid of annual tabs, the actual stickers. Because if you think about it, if a cop pulls you over, he's going to pull up your driver's license. He'll know right on his computer whether your vehicle is expired or not. Do we even need the sticker anymore? Do we even have to go through that?
Well, my understanding with law enforcement is one of the things that tab does do is immediately lets the law enforcement know that the tab is current or not.
Oh, okay. All right.
But I also think that we need to be very cognizant of law enforcement. You know, certainly they are not receiving the public support that they deserve these days. And we are trying to make things so easy and so convenient and so electronic. And we are actually putting our law enforcement in harm's way. So any of those measures, I would certainly want to make sure that we're getting law enforcement's buy-in.
The other topic we wanted to talk with you with, Representative, what are we going to do when we have a flood of absentee ballots, presumably coming in the November and possibly the August primary as well, as we move now into our post-proposal 3 world, where we have no reason absentee voting, and folks are being actually invited to vote early. And I know the clerks are expecting additional absentee ballots because of that, and we don't want to become a situation where the nation is looking at us on November of 2020, and they're saying, okay, what's going on in Michigan? And the California results are in, but we still don't have Michigan. Like, how is that possible? Iowa certainly got a beating with their caucuses right now, and you've got some bills to address this, kind of hopefully get in front of this. Tell our listeners what your ideas are.
Okay, so there are a number of bills. One is to increase the precinct size to 5,000. And what that would do is it would free up resources, it would free up equipment, it would free up polling locations, it would free up workers, that we could capitalize on that, maybe have more workers, more booths, et cetera, in a physical precinct, if you will. We are going to see an uptick in absent voters. And so there will be less of a reliance for the walk-in voters in a precinct. So increasing the precinct size, I don't think will really add to additional lines or wait times.
So if you want to go to 5,000, what is it now?
Okay, right now the law allows for 2,999, no more than 2,999, except when you consolidate an election, which you can consolidate under current law, up to 5,000 in a non-federal election. So one of the pieces of legislation also allows you to consolidate in any non-November election. And so 5,000 number was identified as a solid number because it's in current election law. Clerks are familiar with it. We work with it. It came up with out of a working group that I called together. As a former clerk, this was an issue that we had been looking at because there's more and more of a demand on the local clerks to move out of the schools and churches as well. So another bill that I have in is to expand the definition of polling locations that would allow polling locations to be placed, say, in an apartment, community center, clubhouse, take off the burden in the schools that are not wanting us, no longer welcoming us.
Yeah, because now there's security doors at some of these schools and you can't go into them. Now, the one piece of your bill that I thought was particularly noteworthy is you would have an actual precinct where all they would do is count absentee ballots all day.
Yes. So currently under the law, that's called an absent voter counting board, and those are established by the clerk with the approval of their local election commission. As a former clerk, I used an absent voter counting board for every election. In my opinion, think that we should actually require absent voting counting boards across the board. I have another bill to that effect, and the reason why I think that is that you are in one solid location, you kind of become expert and fluent in processing those absent voter ballots. And the most important thing is that you maintain the level of secrecy and adds to obviously the level of integrity when you're administering that election.
So when you do one of those absent counting boards, do they count all day starting at 7?
They take whatever time is necessary. So depending on the election, so let's say it's a small May school election for a millage, then the clerk, through the approval of the local election commission, would then determine the starting time. So if you're only expecting maybe 500 ballots back or 2,000, whatever number you're expecting back, you adjust your time. They cannot start before 7 a.m. on election day, but you may have them start at a later time, 10 a.m. I've had them start as late as 4 p.m. on election day because it's not necessary to have them there the full day counting the ballots. The important thing is that once you enter and are appointed to that absent voter counting board, you are what we call sequestered. You take an oath to secrecy and you are sequestered until the ballots are you complete your counting.
Now, Bob, I wanted to bring you in on this because there's been some other ideas out there that I know Secretary Benson has been supportive of, some Democrats. That's counting the ballots early. What do you think of that?
Well, I think we have to look at all of our options on the table right now. Anytime you make a move like this that fundamentally shifts how people are voting, like Michigan has done, you also have to take a look at how those votes get counted and make sure that there are the systems in place to ensure they can be. So, sure, I think we need to be looking at things like that. If there are ideas to let folks start counting those ballots early, let's take a look at that. But as the representative was saying, make sure it's being done in the proper, secure fashions. So any ideas right now are probably good ideas to be exploring so that we can ultimately come up with a system prior to the elections this fall that ensure that we aren't the next Iowa and California's results aren't coming in before Michigan's. And we do not, and we're doing everything we can to avoid any kind of an election night disaster here in Michigan. So put everything on the table now and figure out what the best answer is.
Jack, you were able to talk to former Secretary of State Ruth Johnson, now state senator. She has some bills to try and head this off. What did she tell you?
One of those bills would be to allow the clerks to have shifts. You'd have a shift that could come in. They'd have to stay for the entire, you know, until 9 o'clock or whenever it is that the election stops. But then you allow another shift to come in and finish off. And that's to prevent people from just being so dead tired at the end when they're boxing things up and counting still, et cetera, to get some people who are fresh in there, which apparently this would be something new. I guess you're not allowed to do that at this point. The other one that was interesting was she was talking about apparently with the absentee ballots, you have two sheets of paper. And she was saying that she thought there was no reason you shouldn't be able to take, apparently one is not sensitive, to be able to separate that out ahead of time. And she said it didn't sound like much, but she was given the example of a community with 63,000 votes. When you multiply just separating out that one sheet of paper, it could save a lot of time and make things a lot easier to prepare to count.
Representative, let's get your ideas on both of these. First of all, being able to count ballots early, what's your thoughts on that?
I am against counting ballots early. I think that it jeopardizes the checks and balances that are in our current system. I think that, 2020 is going to be somewhat of an anomaly. And I don't think that we should throw the baby out with the bathwater in anticipation of something we really don't even know exactly what it's going to end up be. Now, having said that, I think we can expect we're going to have an uptick. I think that tempers are going to be high. And so what can we do to make sure that we maintain checks and balances, maintain the integrity of our elections? And so some of the other things that are out there. I listened to the Senate testimony last week, and some of the clerks from larger jurisdictions, who I have a lot of respect for, clerks will make it happen. They will make sure it happens to ensure that voters can vote freely, secretly, and independently. We have the checks and balances, and the most important thing is to make sure that those precincts are recountable at the end of the day.
But you're concerned, though, that somebody is going to push the button on the Sunday before the election and say, oh, geez, our candidate's down. We're going to have to increase some efforts. You think that could possibly happen?
I think that that could happen, and that's why there's a difference here. You know, we have absent voter voting in the state. We don't have vote by mail. We don't have vote from home. It's absent voter voting. That means the absentee voter from absent on election day. Things can happen. Right now, the law says if you are deceased before election day, your vote doesn't count. All right. If you start counting early, you know, how do we handle that situation? And I think people are suspect anyways on how we are handling our elections, even though we have very sound election law in the state of Michigan. The proposal to open the ballots, but not to do any sort of tabulating or counting is something that we could consider in the form of a pilot. But I don't want to see us completely overturn Michigan's election law in 2020. I think we should be looking at more in the direction of pilots and putting our heads together to come up with a real good solution how we're going to address this. You know, one of the things that was said in Senate testimony last week is it was going to take 13 hours to open these ballots. Well, the polls are open for longer than 13 hours. And if that's our high number, then I think we have some wiggle room within the confines and maybe just making some adjustments for unsealing the envelopes. It is labor intensive, but a lot of the work is up front in the clerk's office.
Your idea of increasing the precinct size, how do you think that will affect voting in Detroit and inner cities where they seem to back up every election and have long lines? How do you think it would affect them?
Well, I don't see that the lines necessarily, increasing the precinct size, in the cases of the larger cities like Detroit, they actually have way fewer than 2,999 people in a precinct. And they have many of their precinct boundaries are by school district, council ward, etc. And so clerks take many different things into consideration when they determine their precinct boundaries. I think that with the ability to have increased no reason AV voting, there will be fewer people's, fewer demand. And I think one of the biggest problems in the city of Detroit, actually throughout the state, is we just do not have enough workers. And I would encourage and actually challenge people, especially maybe some of our large corporations, encourage your employees to volunteer and to work on election day, to be able to participate in the system, to allow people to vote freely, secretly, and independently is awesome. And so I really would encourage that. I think is where we can have the greatest impact, is more people working in the polls.
An election day holiday, I want to end with this with your representative. An election day holiday has been proposed by Kara Hope and Leslie Love, state representatives. What do you think of that idea?
I think that local governments, public schools, public employers, private employers, they need to decide what is best, what holidays that they give off to their employees. I don't think that's our responsibility as a legislature to be dictating that.
Thank you for stopping in. Representative Ann Bolin from Brighton Township.
Thank you for having me.
About Bob, let's talk about Governor Whitmer's performance at the State of the Union response last week. Now, you worked with Governor Whitmer for years. What did you think of how she did and how she presented to the nation?
I think the governor did everything that the National Democrats asked her to do. I think when you're doing a speech like this, it's not a situation where you're swinging for the fences. You're not trying to hit a home run with this. You're really trying to hit a single, advance the messaging of the party, and make sure that you're serving the party well in terms of their talking points and their message. And I think that's exactly what she did. It's a especially difficult task to respond to a speech when it's a response to someone who you have absolutely no idea what may come out of their mouth during the speech in terms of President Trump. So I'm sure it was not an easy task to stick to a message, but she did a great job. I think she certainly gave the Democratic message that they are the party working on issues that matter to families, to workers, come election time, that those are going to be the issues that Democrats are talking about. So it was, I'm sure, exactly what the National Democrats asked her to do, and she did it well.
So were you in East Lansing High School? Or did you watch this on TV?
Nope, I watched it on TV, like I'm sure,
like
many of us did. And I think it came across exactly according to plan. It was a speech delivered in a public school where her kids go. It's a solid message of what most families in America are dealing with in their public schools. And I thought the overall message, the theme was right on.
See, I thought it was the best speech that I've heard her give, and I've listened to her in the Senate, listened to her in the House. I've listened to her on the campaign trail, but this one seemed like she rose to the occasion, like she connected with the television audience. Her message was clear. She was funny at times. She made some good points. She had her classic Whitmer zingers that she threw in there, too. I thought it brought it all together. The only criticism I saw on social media was that it was boring. But you know what? If that's the worst that you got, I think that's pretty good.
Absolutely. I mean, I think if you look at the last couple of weeks of what we've seen of the governor, which is quite a bit, going from State of the State to State of the Union to her budget message, I think we've seen a very aggressive and confident Governor Whitmer. This is someone that spent the first year in office, I think, hoping that she could get some bipartisan agreements on her platform. And this year is going to take a different approach. This seems like a governor that is saying, you know, I don't have a legislature I can work with. I'm frustrated, like millions of people in Michigan, about the state of our roads, about the state of our schools. And I'm going to do what I can as governor to fix those problems. And for as much as I can do on my own, and for the stuff I can't, I'm going to put a spotlight on those that are standing in the way of progress. So whether you're looking at her State of the State address or her State of the Union response, I think this is a governor that knows what she wants to accomplish this year.
Okay, so Sarah, having worked for a governor before, you know how stressful it is to have that State of the State and then the budget kind of back to back. And then you throw in the State of the Union response on top of that. That's just got to be a lot of work they had to have done.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, it's always when people joke about kind of the holidays slowing down. In a governor's office and administration, that's really when things are really ramping up again for the beginning of the year, when you're working on, exactly as you pointed out, State of the State, budget, where you're really kind of putting out your policy priorities to numbers. And then added up with a national spotlight on Michigan with the State of the Union response. So I feel for that team. They probably were not a whole lot of 7 to 8 hours of sleepless nights there.
So you watched the governor's response to State of the Union. How do you think she did?
You know, overall, I mean, I think she really did great on delivery. It was poised, professional, passionate, and brief. You know, I think from an overall kind of hitting those key points, and she clearly, I mean, hit the Democratic priorities and trying to paint that contrast, but really hitting that kind of that audience without being, I think there's some red meat there, obviously, but it wasn't overly partisan either.
Do you see her as a real potential vice presidential possibility?
I think the answer to that question is whether she wants to be a vice presidential candidate. I think you're going to have any number of campaigns that would look at her as a very smart pick for a potential vice presidential running mate.
Biden being one?
I'm sure that is a conversation that the Biden camp has had. I'm sure that's a conversation that a number of campaigns have had.
Well, even think about Bernie. Mm-hmm. I mean, Bernie Sanders. I mean, he needs to come back to the middle a little bit if he becomes the nominee. Gretchen Whitmer doesn't look all that bad.
Of course not. I think you have a younger leader here in Michigan from the Midwest in a state that, of course, they know Democrats know they have to win. There's any number of reasons you could point to that a Bernie Sanders campaign or a Joe Biden campaign or any of these campaigns would say, we need to at least pick up the phone and have that conversation with her. And ultimately, I think she can write her own ticket if she wants it. But the question is, does she want it? I think she has a lot of work to do here in Michigan. Her family's here in Michigan. She may decide that my best place is here in Michigan. But ultimately, she's put herself in a very strong position nationally to say, I can be part of the face of this party nationally if that's a position she ultimately wants to put herself in.
The only campaigns I see right now that wouldn't want her is Mayor Pete Buttigieg wouldn't want to have Indiana, Michigan. Amy Klobuchar, too kind of moderate from the Midwest. I don't think you want to do that either. Elizabeth Warren would be intriguing, though, to have two women at the top of the ticket. Is that too far for America right now? Can we do that?
Look what happened in Michigan last time around. People said you can't have a ticket with four women on it, and that's exactly what we had, and it's exactly what won. Women carried Michigan in 2018. So I think if anyone wants to have that conversation that you can't have two women at the top of the ticket, I think Michigan has blown that narrative out of the water. Women are going to play a very, very large role in this election coming forward. Absolutely, that's a ticket that could succeed.
You figure we've only had two men at the top of the ticket for exactly. Most of the presidential tickets. So
absolutely. I don't see any reason that conversation wouldn't happen as well between those campaigns.
Bob, let's move over to the budget right now, because you've been very involved in the K-12 piece in your role with Tri-County. Tell our listeners a little bit about what you do and what you see as being the most critical part of this budget.
Well, I think schools have sort of been on the back burner in budget discussions for the better part of a decade now. The school aid fund, going back 10 years ago, became sort of a piggy bank for legislators to dip into when they needed to balance budgets elsewhere. And I think schools are starting to grow tired of that. And I think schools are looking for someone to step up and say, we need to make real investments in K-12 education again. And not just in terms of the amount of money that we're spending on schools, but how we are spending that money. And I think the governor's budget that she put forward last week takes into consideration a lot of the research that has said we need to do a better job of that. And so as she's putting special classification on the costs that schools have to absorb on special education, on at-risk students, on English language learners, represents a fundamental shift in how Michigan would allocate funding for public education for the better. And so schools are excited about this budget that she's put into it. This governor, more than any, likes to say that a budget is a statement of values. And I think that this budget shows exactly what she values. It's a public education focused budget. And, she took care of the roads outside of this budget, or at least to the extent that she could. So I think when you look at what she presented last week, the single biggest focus in there is a reinvestment in the right way in public education in Michigan.
So her budget includes this weighted formula, which puts additional money into schools that have high populations of special education students, at-risk students, and also English as a second language students. Now, some would argue that you're taking money out of the base formula then, that other schools would not get as much because of that. What's your response to that argument?
Going back 2 years now, the single largest and complete study of public education financing was done by the School Finance Research Collaborative. It was an independent, bipartisan group of school officials, of business officials, of academics, that really took a look at, not just what the cost of educating a student is, but how do we need to do a better job of spending the existing resources on schools. And what its fundamental conclusion was is that we need to get away from this one-size-fits-all approach to school funding in Michigan that pretends that every student in every classroom more or less costs the same amount to educate, and instead recognize that if you have a student that has particular special education needs, or if you have a student that comes from an at-risk background, that a school is going to have unique challenges and costs of educating that child. And until we start recognizing that, then we are getting further and further away from real equity in terms of public education across Michigan. So by moving in this direction, you actually aren't taking anything away from any student. You're investing in a way that more correctly recognizes the costs that schools face and gives everyone a better opportunity for a positive education experience in Michigan.
So last year, the Republicans passed out a budget for K-12 education that they declared to be the highest amount of funding that went to K-12 ever. And they could do that again this year. It's hard for me to believe that Tri-Counties would be opposed to this.
We would, because when you look at it, you could add a dollar to last year's budget and claim record funding for public education. The question is, does it actually meet the needs of schools? And the answer last year was no. In fact, by passing a budget that they claimed was record funding, it actually meant, when you go talk to school administrators, that many schools in Michigan received a less than inflationary cost increase in their budget, meaning effectively their budgets went down from year to year. So until we are actually investing in ways that take our existing resources, spend them in better ways, and fully recognize that schools have been underfunded for decades now, the idea of just passing a budget that allows you to put a talking point out that says record funding is no longer good enough. And whether it's the Tri-County Alliance for Public Education that I run or some of the other groups that are out there, we're just not willing to accept that anymore. Schools deserve an investment again. Schools deserve the consideration that there's a unmet need out there that we need to fill. And until we get there, I think you're going to see schools become more and more vocal about what our needs actually are.
Sir, I also wanted to ask you about the budget, because Governor Snyder really liked to present the budget. I felt like that was his favorite time of the year. Governor Whitmer decided she didn't want to do it this time. It really is a governor's preference, correct?
You know, it is, absolutely. And I don't know that we'll ever see a time back to kind of a Governor Snyder where he was the one personally presenting the budget every single year, all 8 years of his administration, right? Usually they'll do the first one or maybe the last one or somewhere in between there, but not all of them. He, I think, really broke the mold in that. And you're right. I mean, you got to know him pretty well over the time. I mean, that's where he was passionate about that. And I think people give him unfair criticism sometimes that it was just about spreadsheets and not people. But that was really where he felt like that was how he could actually put kind of the priorities behind the policies and that action, and where your actions speak as loud as or louder than your words, and really demonstrate how committed you are to the things that you've talked about.
It's really interesting when you think about it, because a lot of attention is made to the State of the State Address. But honestly, there's more in the budget than there is the State of the State Address, because you see the dollar signs that go with the priorities, so you really know where they feel the most passion.
Right. You know, I think absolutely. And I think you can see it over whether it's in key kind of priority areas or individual programs, right? And an overall kind of message for where you want to focus the state and the direction you want it to head, but also the people that behind all those policies, too. So you're right. I mean, that's where there are tons and tons of little, big and little details.
Now, one item in the budget that really stood out to me, Sarah, was the fact that the governor put in the Going Pro incentive program for skilled trades, whereas that was one of the items she vetoed. So Pure Michigan she did that with, and also Going Pro. For our listeners who may not be familiar with that program, explain what Going Pro is.
Sure. You know, it's a focus on actually helping connect people with the kind of the jobs of the future. And if you kind of, I guess it kind of noticed skilled trades overall, but it's evolved into way more than that, which is why I think that it can show the broad support from across the state. And it doesn't matter which community or region you're in, there's a growing demand and a need for that, both from a business and employer standpoint, but also the kids of our future, like having those jobs for tomorrow, right? And setting them on a course that is actually going to be successful and really building that talent. I know it can be one of those things where people roll their eyes, but I think overall that's one of the challenges facing the state, from, you know, the K-12 education pipeline all the way on up through higher education, whatever that may be. So I think that's one of those things where I think that was a smart investment that should get bipartisan support across the aisles.
Now, this was a program Governor Snyder had started, and you guys saw results from it, obviously, and maybe I know she wants to do the Michigan Reconnect program where she's training folks at community colleges, but you can do both. I mean, because Going Pro is really more directed toward money toward the companies themselves and training them there, right?
Right. And I think that's overall where you have to look at it holistically of all the different pathways and the ways that you can connect people to a job and the training that is in demand and needed. So I think that'll be one of those interesting things going forward, is how people really put a finer point on that in the days and weeks ahead for the 2020 budget.
One more thing while we've got you here, Sarah. I wanted to ask you about the Good Jobs for Michigan program and getting that sunset lifted or have it go for another year or two. What do you think the odds of that are?
Well, I'd like to say hopefully strong, because I think it's one of those programs where you actually, and it's only was around for 2 years, right? It got enacted in late 2017. And in those 2 years, more than 8,000 jobs in communities across the state, and also that diversification of the economy that really hit on kind of the mobility craze to help make sure we keep Michigan kind of at front and center of that, to advanced manufacturing and other settings, and to pharmaceuticals, staying at the cutting edge of all that. I mean, and the first auto plant in Detroit in how long? A generation. Yeah. I mean, pretty significant, for in a way that had a lot of safeguards in that protected taxpayers and communities. If they don't create the jobs, there is no incentive, period. So you'd like to think, and in fact, in the governor's state of the state, two of the big job attraction projects that she noticed that were made possible because of good jobs for Michigan.
All right, well, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to Ann Boland for coming in, State Representative Jacob Kanzler, Jack Spencer, Mike Malott, and then Sarah Werfel from Trescott Rossman, and Bob McCann from Cover 2. Also, thank you to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Sarah, I don't know if you saw my Twitter feed or my Facebook this past weekend, but we went over to Mount Granger over there on the north side, over the landfill.
I've heard about Mount Granger, but I haven't been there yet. Is that the one where Finn went airborne?
It is the one where Finn went airborne, yes. And so he took a colossal spill and was all arms and legs up in the air. It was pretty traumatic, but of course he was just fine afterwards, but he didn't do it again.
I was just going to ask you if he went down again. I know. I actually went to save that to show Logan he would probably think that was pretty sweet.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what Finn
as
had
long
to
as
do.
He's safe.
Yeah, he had to take my phone on Sunday and show it to all his friends at church about what he did. And then the funny thing is that Frances was all bent out of shape because we didn't get her colossal spill, so she had to do it again.
Oh, no.
So she did another colossal spill, but she did a face plant, and I think it kind of hurt her a little bit. She wasn't very happy.
Yeah, that sledding can be dangerous business, but we at least finally got some snow in mid-Michigan to be able to do that.
Oh, God, no kidding. I'm glad that we finally got some decent weather, some snow, not terribly cold. We can do stuff like this, finally.
Yes. May we have more of it in February.
Oh, amen to that. All right. Well, until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.